when I saw magicians, they didn't look like me. And I just didn't think, I know I didn't want to be a magician's assistant. That's for damn sure. But I didn't think about being it for myself.
This is Unladylike. I'm Kristen, and I do not know a single magic trick. I can't tell you the card you picked from a deck, or even pull a tampon out from behind a stranger's ear. And that is disappointing, because how fun would that be the next time I'm in a public restroom and someone says, does anyone have a tampon? I could be like, oh, well, there's one right behind your ear. But speaking of practical uses for magic, I've got a little story for you. Let's rewind back to the early 1900s. There was a magician named Mercedes Thalma, known as the Queen of Coins. She could manipulate up to 30 coins in what the newspapers called her petite hands. And she was one of these performers that critics were so impressed with because A, she was a woman, and B, she would wear these off-the-shoulder gowns to perform, sleeveless gowns. And folks would be like, well, how does she do it? Where do all the coins come from, if not from up a sleeve? And I love this one story about her that I have no idea whether it is fully true, but allegedly, one day, the Queen of Coins was walking down the street in New York. Some people tried to mug her, apparently not knowing they were about to mug the Queen of Coins, because what did she do? She just started pulling coins out of thin air to the point that muggers were like, what is this woman doing? We're just going to leave her alone. So I really like that. Like, I would like a class in using magic as self-defense. But this episode, we have a far more important illusion to demystify, and that is who gets to be a magician. Perhaps the biggest sleight of hand at work in stage magic is the default male magician. Your Harry Houdinis, David Copperfields, David Blaines. There are probably more well-known Davids in magic than there are women, period. Now, some speculate that this is all natural. This is the way it should be. Because, of course, the power that a magician wields appeals more to the masculine ego. And let's think about the instruments magicians use. The wand, saws, swords with which to stab a woman in a box. All of these things are very phallic and therefore more masculine. Women relegated to magician's side piece is really just old school gender rolling. Historically, that tradition arose from husband and wife magic duos, where the husband naturally takes center stage and his wife naturally is the lovely assistant who does a lot of the important work but doesn't get named. Still to this day, less than 10% of stage magicians are women. And still to this day, our guest, Nicole Cardoza, has never met a fellow magician who looks like her.
Yeah, I haven't met another one of me yet. I'm really hoping to. I hope that the next time I go to like a magic convention, I see somebody like me. And it's been great because as I've continued to perform, I've met so many other Black women that are interested in magic and who are starting out. So I know it's just a matter of time before there's more of us performing on the same stage, for sure.
Nicole Cardoza is a founder of the Anti-Racism Daily Newsletter and Media Platform, which is how I was first introduced to her years ago. She's an entrepreneur, equity activist, cultural visionary, and today on Unladylike, we are in for a magic lesson that no one can pull off quite like she can. Hey!
So when I was little, I saw a magic show. I don't remember much of it, but I know I really loved it.
Did you then get into it as a kid?
No, not at all. I started studying magic about a decade ago, so well into my adulthood. And I remember I had just learned my first magic trick. I was just really curious about the mechanics of stage magic. And as I was studying and I was thinking about all these spiritual practices, I was like, wow, there seems to be a lot of similarities in the way in which stage magic has kind of enthralled audiences around the same themes that we see in spirituality, like this idea of levitation and enlightenment, the idea of being able to conjure or produce something and provide for your community. And so I was really interested in what are the roots of some of the stage magic practices that we see today, and what are the spiritual, religious, you know, ritualistic practices that inspired it. So, yeah. There's so many old books that I either read or borrowed from the library at that time. I started to watch as many documentaries as I could find as possible. And yeah, I just became like obsessed. I went down the rabbit hole, so to speak.
What was that first trick that you learned?
Oh, it wasn't anything wild. It was a trick with a Svengali deck, which is a really beautiful way to enter into magic.
What is a Svengali deck?
It's a type of card deck that you can use to create some pretty magical effects.
How did it feel to even just get that first one down?
Oh, there's always something so satisfying about teaching yourself something new. And to witness magic happen at the tips of your own fingers is, for me at least, such a powerful and humbling experience. So it definitely felt that way.
In the past decade, as you've been, you know, working on the more technical side of your craft, has that also included developing your stage persona? Or is there a stage persona?
Yes, definitely stagecraft and the experience of performing is as important, if not more important, than learning the craft along the way. My stage persona is just me. I don't have a fancy name, or I'm not showing up as somebody else, which is a gift and a curse, depending on who you are and how you feel about yourself, right? So you can say that you could spend a lot of time building a persona and an identity that is separate from your own. But for me, it has been really about discovering myself, being honest with myself and true to myself on stage, which is not easy work either sometimes.
Is there a typical path to becoming a professional magician?
The industry is very homogenous. So you see many people that enter this field follow the same kinds of paths, and engaging with the institutions that we know, the magic venues, the magic camps, magic workshops. I don't think you have to do that to become a professional magician. And I would encourage people to think beyond the norm, right? Whether it's in magic or any other career path that you choose. For me, I've always wanted to pursue magic as an art and be an artist and show up using stage magic as my craft. So I don't see it as my profession necessarily. I see it as my artistry, and I get to do that first and foremost in my life, which I'm very grateful for. But that's very different than building a career, because I'm not looking to magic to be my bread and butter, so to speak. I'm really grateful that I run a few companies that are able to do that. I'm not taking gigs or choosing how I show up as a magician based off of financial goals. And again, what a privilege, right? I'm looking for am I expressing myself in the way that feels aligned to me? Am I creating a beautiful experience for my audience, obviously? And am I telling the stories that I believe deserve to be heard as part of that? So yes, I've always known how I wanted to get into this, but looking at it as my profession for me is a bit limiting because I want to hone my voice and connect deeply with my audiences through this work.
Why do you think it is the case that there are no other yous that you know of at this point?
Well, there's so few Black women that have been in magic throughout history compared to the rest of magicians. And it's not, you know, just a matter of representation of Black women, but women generally and Black people generally in magic. You know, this is a very white male dominated industry. That's certainly been a part of the industry, is, you know, not wanting to hire magicians that don't fit the socialized image of what we think of when we think of magicians.
Why do you think the white male magician is still so much like the stereotypical image?
Gosh, I mean, there's a few reasons. I mean, one is just what we've seen, right? Knowing that stage magic really grew and scaled with white men at its center at the turn of the century. That was also happening at a time where women and marginalized people were being actively either discriminated against or experiencing violence because of their proximity to magic or spiritual practices that were shunned in dominant culture. And so you can't have, you know, women being burned at the stake at the same time as stage magic happening and not think like, wow, there's no woman. I wonder why, you know, a powerful woman, a powerful person of color has needed to be controlled or suppressed and discouraged at minimum from practicing their magic. And so when you see that, and I'm not talking about stage magic, right? I'm talking about what we deem to be voodoo practices, and I'm using air quotes there, or women doing healing practices and making tinctures and being seen as doing something nefarious. Those things, when we have a culture that has actively minimized who can be magical, of course, would create an industry of magicians that are centering, that are white men, that center white men, that celebrate white men. How many stories do we have of fantastical non-white men in superhero stories and in sci-fi? Like, we're seeing this across the board. It's a much broader conversation than stage magic, but who is allowed to be magical? And what are they allowed to do with their magic? And now we have an industry where, you know, historically, until quite recently, you learned from other people and you learned from books, and those books can be inaccessible and hard to find. And so that also creates the conditions of a boys' club, right? Of people that choose who they want their secrets to be told to. You also have to look at the fact that performing venues historically weren't hiring people of color to perform at their spaces. And so there's decades, there's centuries of this reinforcement that has created the conditions that impact us today.
And as you're, you know, describing all of this too, it makes me think about how, you know, in the kind of archetypal magic stage show, you have the male magician, but you might have a female assistant who he can then saw in half.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've definitely like weaponized femininity to be kind of the foil for masculinity on stage. All of the stuff that's happening on stage is at kind of oftentimes at the expense of the woman, right? And like using our dictated westernized notions of beauty to distract. I mean, the wild thing, without getting into it, is that the magician's assistant is oftentimes doing most of the labor to make the effects that the audience loves to see. And it's the magician that gets to benefit, right, to get to put their hands up to either side and take all of the applause.
And does this too intersect with the study you were doing on spirituality and appropriation and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because historically, in most communities in the global majority around the world, you have a lot of women or gender expansive people that are the center of what makes a community magical, right? Of their spiritual, religious, or ritualistic practices are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes led by women and gender expansive members of that community. Also tend to be led by older people too. It's a whole other conversation on like how there's so much ageism in magic, especially for marginalized people in magic. But that's beside the point. Yes, we've always had these leaders that are kind of holding these truths for communities and using them to steward them towards survival, towards thriving, living their best lives. And so It's always surprised me that we don't have that represented in one of the closest artistic crafts to that. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? To stage magic, that is in many ways kind of, it's you know, stage magic has always tried to offer us a lens in which to see the world and draws from these practices that we know to be true and that are oftentimes hard to explain. And so, yeah, I've just never really understood why we don't see ourselves. I mean, I understand it. Because I study this and this is what I do for a living. But, you know, it doesn't make sense with the way in which we deserve to live and the way in which we deserve to celebrate the magic of people that are often excluded from society. And it makes a ton of sense that in a white, cishet, patriarchal society and in a world of white supremacy, that can only exist if we strip people from their magic, literally and figuratively. So why would we have a stage magic industry that wouldn't reflect that, right?
Can you tell me about Ellen Armstrong and her significance?
Ellen Armstrong is one of the few Black women magicians in the United States that we know about. She's the first that we know to have her own solo show that toured across the United States. And I become really enamored about her story because of how intentional she was to create shows for her audiences. How challenging it must have been to be traveling the country performing stage magic, which, you know, didn't have or might not have been as known to her community. You know, at least today when I'm performing, people have seen a magic trick on YouTube or have watched America's Got Talent or something like that. But, you know, really sitting with stage magic in a time that could have been more unfamiliar for the audiences that she was working with, because at this time we weren't allowed to go see shows. Much of the performing arts were segregated. So I'm curious about how much magic her audiences had seen.
Unladies, I have to tell y'all more about Ellen Armstrong. She was truly born to be a magician. So Ellen's parents were Jay and Lily Bell Hartford. She started performing with them at the age of 6. And from childhood, she started developing sleight of hand tricks. She too was into cardistry. And their family act went by the name the Celebrated Armstrongs. They were a very successful touring family group. But here's the thing. Ellen grows up. She's 25. And Ellen is starting to figure out, you know, what she wants to do with her life. And her dad, though, dies suddenly, and Ellen decides that she's going to kind of take over the family business. She is going to step into her father's shoes, or should I say her father's top hat? I mean, it was successful enough of a business that her dad left behind enough money for Ellen to really jumpstart her own career. And so for 30 years, she toured around her show called, get this, The Modern Marvelous Matchless Merrymaking March Through Mystery Land.
So there's such a significance in her story. I believe there'd be more people in magic if they knew of people like Ellen Armstrong and so many of her peers, her family, her father, who is also a famous magician. And I think it's important, I'll just say for me as a Black woman, to amplify her work as I start my own.
And it was also incredible to learn of just how long she performed. Like, it was not just a blip. Like, she was out there for decades.
Yes, it's stated she performed as early as 6 years old when she performed until she couldn't anymore. So she was doing it for her entire life.
On your last tour, you're very intentional about performing when you can in Black churches. Talk to me about the significance and importance of that setting for you.
Black churches are magic to me and to my family and my community. So there's that. I can't think of a more magical place to be gathering. The Black church is a complicated space for many of us. You know, in the same way it provided a haven for us to gather and connect and resist as Black people, Westernized religion has also been a place that has stripped Black people of magic, has mislabeled our spiritual and ritualistic practices as evil or worshiping the devil. And a lot of that is eternalized in our community too. And so for me, to honor stage magic and the possibilities that it implies in a space that has been both expansive and limiting in its own ways, it's an interesting tension for me. And then the other reason is that there are many Black magicians throughout history that performed in Black churches and Black schools and Black spaces for Black audiences because they wanted to connect with their community, and sometimes because they weren't allowed to perform in other types of venues. And so, yeah, I want to sit with that tension, but I also want to honor where our magic, our stage magic, historically has been held to.
Is stage magic culturally taboo at all still in Black communities?
I wouldn't say stage magic is culturally taboo. I think that there is a lot of work to reclaim our voices in magic, not just as magicians, but as audience members too. We have been historically excluded from seeing shows, generationally speaking. And in today's world, we don't see a lot of magic that's really centering us, our stories, our narratives, our culture, our music, our ideas. And so it's an invitation and a reclamation, one step at a time.
Unladies, this obvious fact blew my mind. Part of the gender gap in magic comes down to pockets, to gendered ways of dressing, because a lot of stage magic was developed around the abundance of pockets in men's clothing, whether that's in their jackets, shirts, pants. They've got hidey holes aplenty. What do suit jackets give you? They give you sleeves from which to pull endless scarves. Whereas women's clothes, we know, are notoriously pocket-free.
That's something that we talk about a lot around magic, is the gender expectations of magic. Because there is such a socially understood lens of gender on the white male magician, right? You've got the suit, you've got the bravado, you've oftentimes got the David Copperfield turning it into a rose and giving it to a woman on stage. We don't just have people's identities as men on stage. We have a performance of gender and very binary gender norms. And we have the same thing when we think about the magician's assistant, right? So for every archetypal man that you see on stage, socially, right? Our collective understanding of this, of a man doing magic, we have the woman, the magician's assistant. And I'm sure you and I are thinking about a similar kind of look, like a corset, something short, something tight, very beautiful. And so all of that. And so when we have magic performances, we oftentimes also have these binary gender performances. And as we know, gender exists far beyond the binary and far beyond the performance of gender that we see reflected, have seen reflected in stage magic historically, in mainstream as well, because there are plenty of magicians that have fallen far beyond this gender binary throughout history that have often also been left out of the conversation for this reason, right? And so for me, being queer, and I don't feel like I have to perform my relationship with gender. I'd like to play in my expression, my gender expression and my gender identity. And so when I get asked things well, you're a woman in magic, so what about pockets? I'm that doesn't affect me because I just wear what I want. It's I have been an entrepreneur for over a decade. I am quite familiar with being one of the few in a room, and I am not worried about being perceived as, you know what I mean? Or trying to find success by holding on to a gender expression that the industry might imply is necessary. And so those kinds of conversations to me are a little limiting because I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to show up as a Black woman magician. I'm trying to be a really good magician in the way that works for me. And that might mean I'm wearing a three-piece suit one day, and it might mean that I'm wearing a tiny dress the other day. The more interesting conversation is how do I evolve my routines around what I want to wear, as opposed to how does what women wear versus what men wear affect me on stage? You see what I mean? So it's I'm not trying to be a male magician. I'm not trying to be a magician that identifies as a woman. I'm not trying to fit into either of those. I'm trying to be who I am in magic. And it's hard. It's like a double-edged sword because, of course, the first thing that people want to talk about is being a Black woman in magic because that's what they see. And we know that we haven't had these kinds of conversations, but I'm interested in like the next step, which is what does it look like to kind of like degender or ungender magic? What would it look like if we weren't asking ourselves what the role of a man or a woman would be as a magician? And we're having these conversations beyond magic in many other performing arts. I think it's long overdue for magic, but even the way in which we're trying to create more gender neutral categories for award ceremonies, right? So that non-binary actors don't have to fall into this best actress situation, the way in which red carpets are changing. So the first thing women aren't asked is who they're wearing. So that's where I want the industry to go. And I know that we're not there yet, but that's what I mean when I say, like, I'm not trying to be the Black magician. I'm not trying to be the woman magician. But yes, also, that's what people want to talk about. And that's what I end up talking about all the time. My show talks about Black magicians. So obviously, people are going to ask those questions. But yeah, I would love to take it a step further because I don't think about that when I'm in the mirror performing.
What I'm hearing as well is transcending a standard that is a model that is based around a white male magician of like, to measure success based on the standard set by white men.
Absolutely. Because that, I mean, we have to, even every time all those questions are asked, like, it's still a centering of white man magician. Like, you might as well just have a white man on stage and then have me come up, right? Because you're still asking and centering that figure, mm-hmm. right? And that's step one. Like, for us to understand what else is around, we have to orient ourselves on the whole universe and not just who's at the center, right? So that happens. That's step one. It's like, this is at the center, but here's all these other proximal, you know, experiences. The next thing where I want to go is like, there doesn't have to be a center. I get so much pushback from white men magicians around this, right? Either directly or indirectly, they talk shit about me outside of it, but it's like, it affects them too. Having a set understanding of what a magician looks like also hurts white men. It hurts other people who feel like they have to be closeted, for example, because they can't perform, or they have to hide another part of their marginalized identity, or they have to play into this very narrow expectation of what it means to perform as a man in magic. We're taking out so much of the full expression that all of us deserve. The trouble is that these conversations are starting with the people that are most excluded from this space, right? Or seen the least. And it's not a collective conversation that we're all having, which is really frustrating, but it doesn't serve anybody by not challenging these understandings. And this is just as applicable in stage magic as it is in all parts of our lives. So what's happening here is a microcosm of the larger world. People act like this is a wild conversation to be having. And it's like, no, this is just 101.
There's also just the layer of irony that even in a space that is magic, that is magical, that implies suspension of disbelief, creativity, things beyond, that there is still a box, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Of all things, like we make things travel through time. We challenge the expectations of gravity and space and like all of these things that we know to be true. But it's wild to think that a non-white man would want to be a magician, right? Like, it's actually like, of course, like, why wouldn't you think that the people that have had to suspend disbelief to actually exist in the country that we live in would want to be magic because we are magicians in our own rights outside of the craft of it, right? Suspending disbelief is one of the most powerful and potent practices for our collective survival. Like, how are we supposed to keep going? How are we supposed to arrive at tomorrow if we don't believe that anything better than today is possible? So, yeah. But, you know, I'll just keep doing my card tricks and talking about pockets, I guess.
Well, how has this practice and performing magic, stage magic, what has it taught you about you?
For me, it's, how I show up and what I believe to be true for stage magic is what I've really experienced from it. Also what I've seen to be true, but it's really rooted in like what it's done for me. And I see stage magic as a practice of possibility. it's done that for me in two ways. One, making magic happen at the tips of your fingers. I've loved magic. I've watched it my whole life. I've never even considered doing it until about a decade ago. And I think that's because when I saw magicians, they didn't look like me. And I just didn't think, I know I didn't want to be a magician's assistant. That's for damn sure. But I didn't think about being it for myself. So to step into it and to do it in itself is so humbling and inspiring. And every time I learn something new, I feel that way. But also, it's really forced me to sit about like what makes me feel uncomfortable about myself, like taking up space, showing other people my magic. That is not a small thing. And this is the first thing I've pursued because I've wanted to like make a cultural shift. I've been an entrepreneur for a long time, very used to putting together things for the sake of the company, to fundraise, to generate revenue, to make an impact in that way, but to do things to kind of question or challenge or be an inquiry with some of these bigger themes that we've been talking about has been a really humbling experience. So I've learned what's possible for myself. I've learned to give myself deep patience. And I've been studying magic, stage magic. I started in my early 20s. So this has been like when I have been sitting with my queerness, really understanding my own relationship to my gender. And so it's been a part and parcel experience of sitting in possibility.
How do you think that little 5-year-old Nicole would feel about seeing magician Nicole all grown up?
I really don't think she would have ever thought that experience would be possible. But I did really believe in the magic of everything. I was so gullible, I guess, in some ways, but I also just really wanted to believe. Like when I was little, I was looking for something else. Pokemon, real. Great. Next. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, outside of my sewer, like in the sewers of my apartment building. Like that was just like a thing. And so I think I would see myself perform and be like, okay, bet, that's what I'm doing. Like, I would just like move on. Great, amazing. This is what I'm going to try. So I would have gotten into this a lot sooner.
Thank you so much to Nicole Cardoza. You can follow her at Nicole A. Cardoza on Instagram and TikTok. She just wrapped up a tour, but go to her website, blackgirlmagician.com, to learn more about her and where you can see her performing magic next. And if you want more unladylike tricks and treats, you can head over to the Unladies Room Patreon and listen to the ad-free bonus episode, The Magician is a Woman. Or you can listen to the latest Unladies Room exclusive on SAGS, which is just the perfect acronym for stay-at-home girlfriends. Patreon.com/unladylikemedia or search Unladylike Media in the Patreon app. Please consider going over there to subscribe and support this show. Unladylike is an Unladylike Media production, executive produced, written, hosted, and edited by me, Kristen Conger. Engineering is by Amita Ganatra. Our music is by Flamingo Shadow, Amit May Cohen, and Sarah Tudson. Until next week, what is the most unladylike thing about you?
Oh, gosh. Probably that I don't like being referred to as a lady. Not necessarily my term. I guess that's what I would say is I'm challenged by that.